My name is Noel Joseph Terence Montgomery Needham. I'm from Great Britain. My Chinese name is Li Yue Sir. I have been to China 9 times in my life, and I am eternally grateful for everything I have learned there. Everywhere I have been able to witness its ancient spirit of science and technology. I feel privileged to have seen firsthand this wonderful creativity, the brightest of minds and the noblest of spirits. From this war-torn Asian country burst vitality that borders on the miraculous. It is in this land where such wisdom abounds that the second act of my life began. Beside the Chentang River, to the northwest corner of Hangzhou's famous West Lake, sits the century-old Zhejiang University. On the scenic campus, there's a spot commemorating an event in the 1940s, in the days when the school was known as the National Zhejiang University. In 1937, the Japanese army occupied Shanghai, threatening the neighborhood city of Hangzhou. Zhu Kejun, then president of the National Zhejiang University, led more than 1,000 teachers and students westwards, along with nearly 2,000 crates of books and equipment. They traveled over 2,000 kilometers across the war-torn country and, 28 months later, finally settled in Meitan in Guizhou. This small town, surrounded by mountains, provided a safe haven for the university's staff and students. Temples and memorial halls were emptied for temporary accommodation. The surrounding mountains and forests offered natural shelter. One day, in April 1944, a Chevrolet truck climbed the rugged mountain roads to reach the small town surrounded by forests. In the truck was a special visitor, Joseph Needham, Fellow of Britain's Royal Society and Doctor of Biochemical Embryology at Cambridge University. In 1943, he had been sent to China by the British government as a diplomat to report on the state of China's education and industry under war conditions. Needham was keen to help the war-torn Chinese universities. This was Needham's second year in China. He had already visited the Southwest Associated University in Kunming and National Dongji University in Lijiang. This time, he was coming to the relocated National Zhejiang University, which had been very active in scientific research. Full of curiosity, the British scientist walked into the Confucian Temple in Meitan. It had been built in the Ming Dynasty and covered about 1,500 square meters. It now housed the National Zhejiang University's offices, library, classrooms, and dormitories. Needham looked with interest at the teachers and students having classes in the temple. It was here that he met Dr. Zhu Kejun, renowned meteorologist, educator, and the director of the Institute of Meteorology of the Academia Sinica. From this photo that Needham took of Zhu Kejun, it appears that the latter was a little nervous when they met for the first time. The quiet and reserved Zhu Kejun may not have immediately hit it off with his lively and loquacious visitor. But in the days that followed, and as Needham got to know more about the university, he became more and more impressed by Zhu. Those days in the remote southwest, far from the sophisticated city of Hangzhou, were the most difficult for the Zhejiang University. To encourage teachers and students, Zhu Kejun promoted the slogan, "Overcome all difficulties, take all risks in pursuit of true knowledge." He had the students establish laboratories and farms, as well as building Guizhou's first sports field with a 400-meter standard track. Inspired by the idea of unity of knowledge and action, advocated by Zhu Kejun, the entire university devoted itself to the transformation of this area of rural China. This creativity was recorded by Needham's camera. The agricultural school cultivated rice and 15 other crops for local promotion. Tanja Jun continued to conduct genetic research with local biological resources. Nutritionist Luo Dengyi, after surveying more than 170 kinds of fruits and vegetables in Meitan, discovering the fruits of the chestnut rose rich in vitamin content and teaching the local people how to make juice from it. In Meitan today, it is still known as Luo Dengyi's fruit. These developments excited Needham. He had high praise for the university's ingenuity and determination, despite the unpromising surroundings. Needham's comments were recorded in Zhu Kejun's diary with pride. Looking through Zhu Kejun's diaries that are archived in Zhejiang University, one can find that, in addition to Needham's praise for the school, Needham's speeches and comments on China's science and technology were also recorded in detail. Right here in this temple, Needham gave a series of lectures on China's science and culture. He enthusiastically shared his findings with Zhu Kejun. China had boasted many advanced ancient technologies that had, for some reason, never developed further. He was planning to write a book to describe these achievements in the context of the world history of science. Needham didn't realize the impact his views would have on the outwardly placid Zhu. When Zhu was studying at Harvard in his early years, he had taken courses with George Sarton, a founding father in the history of science as an academic discipline. He had written several papers on the history of science in ancient China. After returning to China, in addition to his meteorological research, Zhu had continued to maintain this interest. Zhu regarded China's history of natural science as a treasure house and part of the history of civilization. At the same time, he recognized that the study of the ancient history of natural science in China barely existed. However, in time of war, Zhu Kejun didn't have the luxury of time to worry about this. He had to prioritize the university's survival. Then, suddenly, an enthusiastic and talented scholar from the West appeared. One who was keen to introduce Chinese science and civilization to the world. Zhu Kejun was privately delighted and decided to lend Needham his full support. As soon as the war ended, Zhu Kejun moved the university back to Hangzhou. He decided that for each ancient book, if the university had more than one copy, one would be sent to Needham in Cambridge. These texts would become key resources for Needham's research and writing. Those few days of exchange during the war led to a lifelong friendship between the two great scholars, one Chinese, the other British. After the war, Needham repeatedly invited Zhu Kejun to participate in meetings of the International Congress of History of Science so that their peers from around the world could hear the voice of China. With Zhu Kejun's advocacy and organization, the Chinese Academy of Sciences established its History of Science Research Committee in 1954.
纳入国家规划了，然后五六年就开始，很快就推动成立这个研究所，人都已经调来了，像李岩先生已经都调到这儿，叶吉尊先生也经常到历史所去这边来，说竺可桢先生也亲自顾问。On
January 1st, 1957, the Institute for the History of Natural Sciences finally began its work. Chinese scholars began to study their own history of science and technology. After the founding of the People's Republic of China, Needham's trips to China were supported and assisted by Zhu Kejun. In his preface to Science and Civilization in China, Needham pointedly praised Zhu Kejun as their greatest benefactor. Even today, students at Zhejiang University are familiar with the story of Zhu Kejun and Joseph Needham. Two great souls, oceans apart. One was passionate and fierce, the other warm and radiant. The impact of their intellectual exchanges transcends nationalities, borders, and time, shining brightly to this day. By the spring of 1944, Needham had bidden farewell to the National Zhejiang University in Meitan and embarked on his next journey. His plan was to cross the entire of Guizhou, take trains to zigzag his way through Guangxi and Hunan. Then, finally, to take the highway from Guangdong to his destination, Fuzhou. The route relied on gaps between Japanese-occupied areas. It was a plan fraught with danger. But for Needham, temptation outweighed fear. On May the 19th, 1944, after over a month on the road, Needham finally noted in his diary that he had reached Fuzhou. He wrote the characters for Minjiang River in Chinese. The Minjiang River flows east through the ancient port city of Fuzhou into the sea. China's southeast coast has enjoyed relative prosperity, together with a strong performance in industry and education. Needham was excited to learn about China's shipping industry. He had been in China for over a year. This was his first time on the coast. He wrote in his diary, "Fuzhou is a very modern city, smelling of the sea." Needham wanted to see one particular place, the starting point of Admiral Zheng He's Grand Fleet's voyage to the Western Oceans. Where the Minjiang River joins the sea stand five giant rocks. Their shapes are said to resemble five tigers, so it is known as the Five Tiger Gate. It was here that Zheng He's vast fleet left the motherland for the oceans and the world beyond. Needham stood on the shore, visualizing Zheng He's treasure ships leaving port. Deeply impressed by the Chinese people's seafaring adventures and maritime expeditions, he later remarked in his book, "During the first half of the 15th century, while the Portuguese were creeping down the west coast of Africa, the Chinese were examining the east coast at least as far south as Mozambique."
The 1420年左右 中国船的数量，船队的数量，比亚洲、比全亚洲的国家来得多，比欧洲任何一个国家，这是李维斯的评价，这是很真实的。明代一四零五年郑和下西洋，那船队一次出去就100多条船。
From these models in the Quanzhou Maritime Museum, one can sense the grandeur of Zheng He's fleet all those hundreds of years ago. Some of the largest of them were over 100 meters in length. They were fully equipped to handle ocean navigation. Zheng He sailed through the Spice Islands to South Asia and on across the Indian Ocean to East Africa. Needham's rigorous and inquiring mind posed the question, what supported the expeditions of these huge fleets? This sunken ship, wrecked near Quanzhou, may have given him some clues. It was a medium-sized ocean freighter, 24.2 meters long and 9.15 meters wide, from the Song Dynasty, around 200 years before Zheng He's time. The parallel compartments dividing its hull formed a design Needham deeply admired. Devised in the Tang Dynasty, it greatly improved the safety of navigation. In ocean voyages, even if one or two compartments are damaged and flooded, the watertight bulkheads will stop water flowing into other compartments, which would cause the ship to founder. According to Needham's research, Europeans adopted this technology only in the late 18th century. Obviously, Needham highly appreciated China's navigation technology. Many years later, when writing the Science and Civilization in China series, he devoted a fascicule specifically to civil engineering and nautics. In this fascicule, he described in detail the significance of bulkheads. Another equally significant technology was also mentioned. When sailing the ocean, it is common to encounter bad weather. On cloudy or rainy nights, it's impossible to navigate by stars. How did the ancient Chinese ensure accurate navigation in such conditions?
这个勺子放到任意一个角度，然后碰它一下，触碰它一下啊，然后它就会晃晃悠悠，会自己指南。如果在没有达到指向南方之前，它由于摩擦比较大，停下来的话，其实再碰一下，它就会指的比较准了。
This divination tool originated in the Han Dynasty at the turn of the first millennium. It's made from magnetic stone. The stone is polished into the shape of a spoon. Placed on a smooth surface, the handle always points to the south.
把它放进去以后，把这个板插上。
This primitive compass, copied by the Institute for the History of Natural Sciences, shows perfect magnetic field lines under test. Needham suspected that this tool had developed into mature magnetic compasses, which were used in navigation by the Song Dynasty. As a result, navigation maps began to appear, a revolutionary step in navigation technology. Needham thought it was an accumulation of such unique inventions in China that eventually led to the great era of navigation in the Ming Dynasty. However, a puzzle was also formed in his mind. During its heyday, the Ming Navy was much stronger than those of any other Asian country. Even the combined navies of the whole of Europe couldn't match it. But in the mid-16th century, the Chinese fleet began to fade as the empire closed its borders. In contrast, European navigation led to the discovery of the New World and ushered in a new era of global trade. Why did the wheel of history turn like this? The more Needham learned about China's past achievements, the more puzzled he became. These questions strengthened his resolve to write a book exploring China's technologies and civilization. Through Needham's second year in China, he was accumulating ever more photos, materials, and notes. The framework of the project began to take shape as Needham continued to observe, travel, and think. In addition to nautics, he planned to include in this book a subject that appeared repeatedly in his notes and photos: mechanical engineering. From Chinese Noria to dragonbone water lifts, the looms to water-powered stone mills, Needham discovered the Chinese facility for devising sophisticated machinery to solve practical needs. These items, common enough to Chinese people, amazed Needham. He felt he could see why in classical Chinese the word for machinery also stands for wit, ingenuity, and wisdom.
I think he was just impressed with human ingenuity, the different ways that people have found to answer their particular problems. And he found in China endless ingenious solutions to particular practical problems.
Of all the exquisite machineries, one piece fascinated Needham the most. This was the water-powered astronomical clock tower, invented by Su Song and Han Gonglian in the Northern Song Dynasty. In addition to serving as observatory and a timepiece, it can make celestial demonstrations. The accuracy of its time-announcing function is in no way inferior to that of modern clocks. Needham called it heavenly clockwork. Su Song left behind illustrated instructions for the clock tower, but due to its complexities, no one in the following generations could recreate it, and it was gradually forgotten by history.
1956年的这个水运仪象台啊，就再一次的出现在人们的视野里，而且把它定的挺高的，就是李约瑟。他第一个根据新象法要这个书里的图说，给了个系统总图。那么这篇文章在1956年的3月在Nature上发表了以后，是影响是蛮大的。
Needham's research and attempt to recreate the clock tower inspired his Chinese peers to do the same. Today, in Fujian Province's Tong'an, Su Song's hometown, one can find a full-size replica of the astronomical clock tower. Walking into the tower, one can clearly see the part most admired by Needham. The ingenious mechanical device uses the water flow to accurately measure time. Needham praised this control mechanism as a clock escapement, first invented in China much earlier than those of European clocks.
他是第一个把中国宋朝的这样一个机械装置放在世界的机械史里边看，给了他一个很高的地位，甚至他说这是世界机械钟表的直系祖先。李约硕把世界机械钟表的发明和秦仲机构提前了几百年，这就是李约硕对这件事的一个认识，可以说他是第一个系统的发现了中国的水域象台。在天文仪器和机械学这个两门领域里边的国际地位的一个学者。
At the end of the 11th century, technological innovation in China had reached this peak. Needham described this astronomical clock tower in detail in the fascicule on China's mechanical engineering.In the Science and Civilization in China series, Needham listed over 100 unique inventions in ancient China. They include advanced technologies such as papermaking and ferrous metallurgy, exquisite machinery such as the patterned loom, silk reeling machine and trip hammer, and familiar items often ignored by the Chinese such as the wheelbarrow, the winnowing machine, water lifts and piston bellows.The majority of these unique inventions are undisputed. Some may require further verification. Some later scholars came to see that Needham admired Chinese culture so much that he may have been inclined to exaggerate his findings.
有些学者在说李约硕是中国的爱好者，用现在的话说就是粉丝，中国文化的粉丝。所以说他有的时候说话呀很自然的，他就说过头，说点过头话。他倒不是为了抓眼球，他是真的喜欢中国。
After staying in Fuzhou for a few days in the spring of 1944, Needham got word that the Japanese army was about to lock down the entire southeast of China.He must leave Fuzhou as soon as possible and return to Chongqing. Needham hurriedly drew up this roadmap on the return journey. It indicated the dangers to be faced. He must pass through Hongyang in order to reach Chongqing. If he couldn't reach Hongyang before the trains to the southwest were stopped, Needham and his companions would be trapped.The return was a desultory affair. The quiet villages they had passed through a few weeks ago had been destroyed by war. The truck was already in bad shape as they left Fuzhou. Halfway through the journey, the fuel system broke down. Needham came up with the solution, arranging one person to sit on the car's fender and feed gasoline directly into the carburetor with a tube.On the radio, the Japanese army was getting closer and closer. Needham's diary became scribbled. He wrote, "Progress very slow." After 3 days of hectic driving, Needham finally managed to catch the train to Chongqing.The carriages were crowded with refugees. The panicked passengers were surprised to find a foreigner amongst them. The more so that he was even trying to boost morale by leading everyone in song. To the moans of wounded soldiers, the clucking of chickens and ducks, and faint singing voices, the train crossed the Hongyang Bridge. Needham.Had just had a lucky escape from the Japanese encirclement. 2 days later, Chinese forces destroyed the bridge to block the Japanese advance and the east-west artery across the country was severed. This journey left an indelible impression on Needham. It was the first time Needham had faced the real cruelty and suffering of war. The people of China were being persecuted and killed by the modern armaments of a neighboring country. The Chinese once had the most sophisticated technology of the times. Needham kept asking himself these questions. Why wasn't China, the first country to have invented gunpowder and use it in war, able to break free of feudalism? Why didn't its papermaking technology promote the rise of a new social class? Why didn't its compass lead to great geographical discoveries? Why did the country, with such a profound and brilliant culture, such advanced technologies, and such intelligent people, stop developing in modern times and begin to lag behind the West? During his stay of more than 3 years in China, Needham kept thinking about these questions. It would take him 50 years to come up with some answers. The ending of the war in August and September 1945 brought Needham's mission to a close. However, his experiences in China led him to push with others for the founding of UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization. In 1946, Needham went to Paris as head of the UNESCO's Natural Sciences Section, continuing to seek scientific cooperation among all nations. In 3 years, Needham had been to many places in China. He had traveled tens of thousands of kilometers and made countless Chinese friends, from celebrities to street vendors. He visited 296 scientific institutions in 10 of the 18 provinces behind the front lines of fighting. He wrote hundreds of thousands of words in diaries and notes. He had made 2,000 record cards and taken more than 1,000 photos. China of the 1940s becomes vivid through his lens. He described his experience of the Chinese people thus. They are friendly, loyal, diligent, and intelligent. They are stoic and high to accept their fate, but they are also conservative and don't seek change. They are great individualists, even coolies carried personal seals in their pockets. They are deeply influenced by the ancient civil and military bureaucracy, even deities belong to different classes. They don't have the soul of the perpetually unsatisfied Faust. They are the greatest pragmatists. They are rarely rude, but their decent behaviors also reveal the shackles of ethical requirements. In a letter to Lu Guizhun in 1946, Needham expressed his gratitude to her for leading him to experience such a completely different world. Throughout his life, Needham embraced China with care and passion. And with care and passion, he started on his masterwork.